From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell, for some reason, in Simi Valley. Sitting across from Emmy winner, best-selling recording artist, star of one of my favorite movies of all time, Star Booty. And, of course, the star of RuPaul's Drag Race, now celebrating its ninth season, now on VH1, the Emmy-winning RuPaul. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
We were just talking before we got started, and one of the things I've always thought was so great about you is, again, I was saying that you never brought an element of tragedy to what you do. And I remember something you said in your book. You talk about breaking the fourth wall, and you also talk about how people, basically everybody's in drag. Once you're born, you put on clothes, you're in drag. And maybe the difference between you and is that you talk about people who never break character, even if it kills them.
Yeah.
And later on in your book, you reference both Edie Sedgwick and Sid Vicious as examples of that.
Yeah.
And is it that idea of breaking character that sort of keeps you from being tragic about all this?
I believe so. I think once you understand what we're doing here on this planet, all us humans and other life forms, you realize it's really not that serious. And it's to be taken lightly and to have fun with it. And it's important to experience life. And listen, there's tragedy. There's always tragedy. In fact, yesterday I was talking about Tammy Faye Baker. I narrated a documentary on her called The Eyes of Tammy Faye, and we became friends before that and after.
Is that where you met Randy and Fenton on that?
I met them in the East Village in 1985. Actually, we were all from the East Village in New York, but we met at the New Music Seminar at the Marriott Marquis in Times Square. But we all were East Village dissidents, but they did produce The Eyes of Tammy Faye, the documentary on her. But yesterday I was telling someone that Tammy Faye really was an ascended master. She, you know, people saw her as a Pollyanna. And you got to remember, Pollyanna understood the darkness. She understood there was darkness. She chose to focus on the light. In fact, I was telling someone yesterday, about 5 years ago, Tammy Faye appeared in my dream, and she said to me, "Rue, focus on a person's innocence, not their guilt." And it's that approach to life, which is to focus on the light and to not take life too seriously, emphasis on too seriously, has helped me keep a balance in my life and a lightness about it. Because if I wanted to focus on my black rage, I got it. But I'm not going to go there yet. I don't know. This interview isn't over yet. But
in some ways, it probably is. Wow, imagine the star of Star Booty going to Black Rage. I couldn't imagine that happening. But as you're talking about serious, and in your book, the introduction, your drama teacher, Mr. Pinnell, tells you, don't take life too seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, you started from there. It really is a mantra for you, isn't it?
It really is, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go back to, and I meant to bring your first book for you to autograph, so I got to get that to you.
Okay.
But you talk about who you are, your persona being a mixture. Let's see, let me make sure I got the components right. Diana Ross, Bugs Bunny, Joseph Campbell, and Cher.
Yeah.
I would throw in a little bit of George Clinton in with that.
I love George Clinton.
Because I think that's part of it, too.
Yes.
I think you were trying to not scare anybody off with your black rage.
Yeah.
But not bringing, but I just think you have an eye for the absurd.
Yeah.
When did that start for you?
Started from the very beginning. Even as a kid, I felt like the anesthesia wasn't working. It's like I wanted to drink the Kool-Aid. It wasn't working. And I remember thinking, even I'm talking about 5 years old, thinking I wanted to reach out to other people and go, are you seeing that this is all really an illusion? And everybody was playing along. And I wanted to break the fourth wall and say, hello, anybody? And I got to tell you, it wasn't until probably 1971, on PBS, I found my tribe in Monty Python's Flying Circus. And I went, oh, okay, there are others like me out there. They exist. My goal now is to go and find these people. So I always thought it was absurd, always.
I mean, but what you're talking about with Monty Python, which is, for one thing, consistently breaking the fourth wall, even in the middle of something that was supposed to be this thing, they would break narrative. And for you, the idea, I mean, because I was the reason I keep referencing Star Booty, because you keep doing that, and I can't help but think that Tyler Perry saw that. Because the way you sort of break the wall in those films, I mean, that idea of constantly sort of saying, isn't this crazy?
Right, right.
Is this thing that I always think of for you? I mean, but not saying, not downtrodden, but was sort of like a sparkle and sort of a smile of disbelief.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've got to add to Bugs. I said that in the book too. Bugs Bunny, which probably predates my obsession with Monty Python, where it's always wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Don't take it too personally. Don't take any of it too seriously. In fact, drag
is something Bugs Bunny did.
Probably my first introduction to drag was watching Bugs Bunny, and the way he used it as a way to trick people to, again, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. That is the way to look at this life, really.
But that sense of, because all these people you're talking about having influenced you all have a sense of ownership of their persona. And is that something that appealed to you, too? Did you see that early on?
Absolutely. I had a sense that there was something about me. First of all, my mother, when she was pregnant with me, saw a psychic who said, it's going to be a boy, and this boy will be famous. So I started out with my mother telling me that, knowing that I had a purpose, that there was something out there for me. So I had a sense of that. And then in between becoming famous and my mother telling me that, I had to sort of navigate a way to keep my equilibrium. There's a lot of pot involved in that. and a lot of traveling around and discovering what I could do, and actually a lot of shedding certain domesticated ideas.
Like what? What do you mean?
Well, when I did find my tribe, I eventually found them in Atlanta, Georgia.
You were saying that, in Atlanta. What was that Atlanta like for you?
Well, it was my first foray into my tribe was in music theater. I went to the Northside School of Performing Arts, and these were really out there kids. This is 1976, and the middle of the sexual freedom and gay rights, women's rights, civil rights. In fact, Atlanta was enjoying this boom. After Maynard Jackson was elected mayor of the city, my brother-in-law and my sister said, we're going to Atlanta because it's happening right there. And
the
it really was.
City too busy to hate.
Exactly. And there's an energetic force field in Atlanta, and it's always been there, and it allowed me to really blossom. So these kids I was going to music theater school with, wild ideas, and they challenged some of the things that I had brought with me from San Diego, even things I had inherited from my parents and their parents, or the Black rage and identity and that kind of stuff. And for me to excel in that situation, I had to let go of some of the chips on my shoulder. All cultures come with baggage, that is inherited from generation to generation. And I had to quickly learn, don't take anything too personally and shed as much as you can of the baggage, the hurt, the pain, the Black rage.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to the author, the creator of Supermodel, You Better Work, and he's been working ever since 1983. RuPaul, of course, the new season of RuPaul's Drag Race is now on VH1, Emmy winner. In the first book, you sort of talk about that. The idea is sort of like shedding, but also holding on to things as a way of understanding who you are. Mm-hmm. And this becomes a question I've always wanted to ask you. How do you decide what to let go of? Because there are things you talk about that you have to keep just to remind yourself who and what you are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I knew and I had to let go of being offended easily, and that if I'm offended by something or what someone says, it has little to do with me and mostly to do with them. So for me to move in all these different circles, a lot of times I was the only brown-skinned person in these situations, I had to not be so easily offended by things.
Funny as you're saying that, though, because that's one of the things that I think makes the show work, because you're sort of reminding people what they should and should not hold on to. And it's, I think people understand that you lead your life as kind of a working autobiography. Mm. And so much of that is visible in the show, isn't it?
Yes, it is. These kids who apply to be on our show are so courageous. They come from so many different backgrounds, but similar backgrounds in that society has said, you're not right. And if you want to play with a feminine palette, we can't accept you. Thrown out of their family homes, society, it's school, the kids don't understand what they're doing. So, even with that adversity, they still thrive, they still find their light, and that's where we all come together. And it's so beautiful to hear their stories and to commiserate on how we were all able to get here. It's my story. It's actually the story of so many people watching around the world. This show is on VH1 here in America, but on Netflix around the world, in places like Saudi Arabia and Asia, really oppressive places. And I think that the human spirit recognizes that plight, and I think that's the real appeal. Aside from the drag and the bangles and beads and paint and powder, it's the story of the tenacity of the human spirit and how it will thrive like a lotus in a mud field,
But to go back to that mixture of what you are, you mentioned Joseph Campbell. How much of your life is about the hero's journey?
Well, all of my life is about the hero's journey. Everyone's life. We are all that hero. That's why the figures like Jesus Christ and Krishna and Buddha resonate so wonderfully with all of us, and Superman, because we are the hero of that 1,000 faces. We are that seeker. And I realized I was a seeker from the very beginning. I grew up in the 70s, so that was the time of all these self-help books, and I read them all. I just was so hungry for the instruction book. This is the thing, is that what happens is you have to learn the rules before you can toss them away. So first of all, know thyself. That's first and foremost. And that's where the selfishness comes in. Then toss it away. Toss it off. It doesn't make sense to the mind. This makes no sense to the mind. It makes sense to the soul. And this is an answer that your brain will not understand. But this is where you have to go into your being to really get it. I hold dear the right to love something with all my heart and to absolutely hate it at the very same time. They live in the same place for me.
Well, because I just thinking back to those days in New York when you were this light in the drag world. Mm-hmm. So much of it was about darkness and anger and playing on those archetypes of rage, of being dispossessed.
Yeah.
And that was not something you ever did. I mean, early on, that was you. Was that something you picked up around all those theater kids when you were in Atlanta, that idea?
Well, you know what? It goes back to, let me give myself away. It goes back to my love for the Queen of Motown, Diana Ross. Because I knew that based on her doctrine and many others, that you have to have a standpoint. You have to have a voice or a purpose to why you're on stage. And so early on, I adopted Everybody Say Love. Everybody Say Love. And I've been saying that on stage. There's footage of me on YouTube saying it as early as 1982, And I say it to this day. And I knew that I needed to have a foundation. I needed to have a platform and what my voice would be. And it would be that. So, when I was on stage in the East Village and in all the clubs, and it was a breath of fresh air during the Reagan 80s for someone to say, everybody say love. Let's focus on the love. And again, that's why I'm attracted to someone like Tammy Faye Baker or even Joseph Campbell or
Dolly Parton, who is
that
too.
Absolutely, absolutely. Focusing on the positive. Once you turn the lights on in the darkness, you realize there's really nothing to be scared of. What's really scary is owning your power, of owning your light. That is a much bigger animal concept than, people sitting in the dark wearing all black, smoking clove cigarettes with a beret or, wearing sunglasses in a nightclub, that's just posing. You turn the lights on and you say, okay, who are you? Are you prepared to show us who you are? That's a much bigger concept and actually scarier.
We're going to take a break while I go put on my beret and snap my fingers. My guest is RuPaul. It's The Treatment This Morning. Come stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. My guest is RuPaul, the star of many other things. Among many other things, I mean to say, is RuPaul's Drag Race, now celebrating its ninth season on VH1. Did the Emmys scare you at first?
No. I didn't think I was going to win. I've always worked outside of the system, and the Emmys is part of the big system of television. And, you know, the fact that our show is even on the air is a miracle. You know, it's not the kind of thing that the system sort of puts out there. So, no, I the fact that we were nominated is like, great. Oh, that's great. You know, I didn't think we're going to win. That's not me being pessimistic. It's just I never budgeted in the concept that I would need validation from the system. I was never part of the system. I've always been a fringe outside the system. So for them to say, hey, come and join us, I was like, okay. Oh, sure. Yeah.
But you said in both your books, when you achieved success in the mainstream is when you were being yourself rather than trying to be this version of yourself that you thought people wanted.
Yeah.
So it seems like every step of this success has been about validation, again, of going back to what I said in the first half, your ownership and all these icons that you celebrate and have made a part of who and what you are all people who own themselves. Mm-hmm. And you talk about Diana Ross. She's somebody who was that early on,
mm-hmm.
you know. But again, so was Dolly Parton. And we're roughly the same age. We could watch Cher growing up and taking ownership of herself.
Yeah.
Which, just watching, seeing all these different figures do that, was that an inspiration to you too?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I as a kid, or as most kids do, you know, you hitch your wagon to a star and say, I want to go there. And then once you get there, you realize you don't really need that star anymore. It's a guide. And it's important to find guides and to emulate or to just sort of follow a path. But I knew I had my own unique path. But I use those stars as like a fuselage to a rocket. You know, the fuselage propels the rocket into space. But at one point, that fuselage has to break off and that rocket is on its own. And I've use those stars the same way, you know, Cher and David Bowie and Diana Ross and Dolly Parton. But today, I'm out there orbiting on my own.
So what are you saying that, though? Because the pop stars who last are not one thing. And if we look at the people you enumerated, they've all shifted from one thing to another. Mm-hmm. It's funny. I still think of you as being a singer.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
And I wish you would do that more because it's such a great voice.
Thank you.
That first album is really a terrific piece.
Thank you.
And I've so often thought of you as being somebody, especially when you sing, who sang in character.
Mm-hmm.
You were actually not just doing RuPaul, but you were actually becoming whoever that character was in those songs.
Mm-hmm.
Was I wrong in thinking
No,
that?
You're not wrong at all. No. I knew, even for my mother saying, okay, you're going to be famous and all that, I didn't know what tools I would use. I knew, I figured I'd use all the tools. So music, I love it, whether it's acting or producing a television show or designing clothes or figuring out how to market something that is thought of as subversive in our culture, which is drag, and how do you market that to the universe, to the world? It's like chemistry, really. I knew I needed to take sexuality out of drag for it to be palatable for grandma and grandpa, for Betty and Joe beer can out there. And those are the kind of puzzles I like to solve.
But I guess the reason I was bringing up the music, and you just sort of hit on it a minute ago, is all these parts of the puzzle you like, you get to do in song.
Mm-hmm.
You get to be a person. If it's a tragic song, if you're doing, you know, Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards, you get to be more of the party person.
Yeah.
But each of those songs in the first three albums,
uh-huh.
as you basically, it's almost a review act.
Yeah.
And I kind of wonder if you basically brought your stage act into the recording studio in some ways when you were doing that.
Well, you know, I my latest album, which is called American, is really my reaction to what happened politically in this country in the past year. And it is my voice. It is part of the persona that I've created, something that the people who buy my music are used to buying it for. You know, I have a song called Kitty Girl where I say, you know, yeah, girl, yeah, uh-huh. Actually, I worked with Rebecca Romaine on a TV show called Skin Wars, and she said, you know, I went to iTunes and I bought all of your music, and they're all the same song. You talk about walking and working and get it, girl, and go, girl, and get it, and walk on.
She's clearly never heard Back to my Roots,
well,
but that's another conversation.
That's another thing. But yes, I do other songs, but my audience has come to rely on me. Just like if you go to Heinz Ketchup, there's a certain flavor you're looking for, and I always serve that. But on American, my latest album, I do hit on political things, and I do talk about my love relationship with my husband, who I've been with for many years, and I talk about a variation of things, but all of my staples are on all of my records, which is, you know, obviously uplifting things like Everybody's in Love and go out there and you can do it. You can do it. Walk on. You look great. You are fabulous.
My guest who's trying to work out his 57 varieties is RuPaul. He's the star of RuPaul's Drag Race on VH1. Well, one of the things that I find fascinating, and it's got to fascinate you more than anybody, is that we're at a point where drag is both accepted and still discomforting to some people. I mean, that we could get to this point of apparent progressism, but still where there's this amount of trepidation. We see the anxiety sometimes the very first time when all the queens are out on stage, yeah, and they don't quite know what to do. Because the idea of being around that many of you, uh-huh, seeing that you're part of a tribe, yeah, for the first time, but you're also being judged as part of a tribe.
Yeah.
It's so, that to me is where the real chemistry comes in, because yeah, these queens are exposing themselves in public, being on stage with people who like them, but also there's a competition element to
sure,
it, too.
Sure, yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, drag has been accepted more because our show is around, but...
But it's not just the show, it's you. I mean, and we talked about this shape-shifting. Every step you've taken has been a step that's made drag more accepted in this country.
Well, our goal with the show when we started out was really to celebrate the art of drag, you know, because during the Bush era, it had really gone way underground. In fact, I went underground for a while. But the thing is, I don't believe drag will ever be completely accepted because it is about mocking identity. And we in an egocentric culture are all about identity. You know, we are all about what it says we are on our driver's license or our birth certificate. And that is exactly why drag will never really be mainstream, because it challenges people to deconstruct their whole belief system. And nobody really wants to do that. Nobody wants to break that fourth wall and say, wow, who am I? Who am I really?
Let me ask you this, though. At a time where, because of the internet, things change at the speed that because of technology that no one could ever imagine. In generational terms, I wonder if that wall breaks down for younger people constantly, and that's why you're finding that you're as vital now as you were 30 years ago.
I do believe that. You know, we do a thing called RuPaul's Drag Con here in Los Angeles, and then we do it in New York. We actually, it's coming up on September 9th and 10th in New York at the Javits Center. It is filled with 12 and 13-year-old kids, boys and girls, mostly girls, who are those forward future thinkers who don't have the hang-ups and the shame attached to shape-shifting that their parents did or even their older brothers and sisters did. So I believe it is changing. In fact, I believe that part of what happened politically in this country over the past year is part of that. It's this movement of really thrusting ourselves into the 21st century, and the 20th century is not happy about it. So, like a butterfly that's emerging from the cocoon, it's a violent process, and what we're experiencing right now is a violent process of this emergence. And those 12 and 13-year-old kids who come to DragCon are part of that emergence. They don't have any of that baggage. They can multitask, they can shapeshift, and they are the future.
For me, though, so much this is about the way, as African Americans, the culture exists for us. We have to constantly examine ourselves, in some ways change, because we walk into a room as the only person of color. We've got to read that room and be able to figure out who and what we are. We have to always understand what we are, which makes us forward thinkers. But at the same time, there's a lot of conservatism in the Black community,
too. Oh, yes.
So as an artist, you are more aware of that than anybody.
Yes. You know, I'm going to tell you something, I'm going to tell you anyway. You know, I went to Amplify, which is a consortium down that was put together by my agency, CAA, and they were lovely to do. It was beautiful event. And it was brown-skinned people. It was African-American, Asian, Latin. And we all were all there with the purpose of moving the conversation forward. Well, all the top dogs in the business were there. But I got to tell you, you know, I met a lot of them for the first time, and there was still this standoffishness with me. And I understand it very well, because I've lived that way my whole life. You know, when I was a kid, I'm from San Diego, I would take the bus out to the beach. And when I returned to my neighborhood, which was all predominantly African-American, well, it was all African-American, I was going to say predominantly, they would say, oh, you must think you're better than us. You think you're white or something? But when I went to this event, it was called Amplify, I got kind of the same vibe. And it was from the leaders in the industry. And it was disappointing to experience this at this consortium where the concept was to move the conversation forward. And I know that, I know the situation very well. The truth is, you can't carry with you all of that mishigas and baggage from before into the future. You've got to throw it away. Like, and the way we started this conversation, which was, you've got to be able to shed some of the baggage if you want to move the conversation forward. And I feel even today that most folks aren't willing to do that. I think young kids are. I think those 13 and 12-year-olds who come to DragCon, they are. But, you know, the leaders of industry, of color, of, you know, they were not. They were not. And I could, if I told you names, it would curl your hair. No pun intended.
Clearly, this is radio. He has no idea what my hair looks like.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, and it's disappointing. But you know what? We are moving forward. We're doing it with our show, RuPaul's Drag Race. We're doing it with DragCon. Those people, God bless them. God bless them. But, you know, I've had to shed those things. The reason I'm here today is because I was able to shape and shift and change my mind about my identity as a victim. I am not my grandfather's storyline. I am to a certain degree, but I'm not any of the victimness, or I'm not holding on to that as an identity.
Which is also where we started. And we're out of time, and I've taken up too much of your time. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
My guest is RuPaul, the star of RuPaul's Drag Race on VH1, author of many best-selling books, many best-selling records. We have to do another show to get to all this. Please come back and do the show again.
I would love to.
Our recording engineer here in the freezing Simi Valley, it's cold here, who also mixes the show, is Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Vitus, associate producer. I'm going to go and curl my hair. It's the treatment. Catch up on past episodes with The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.